Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Roberta Hatcher. Roberta Hatcher earned a PhD in French literature and African studies from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She has taught at the College of William and Mary, the University of Pittsburgh, and currently teaches in the Department of Modern Languages at Duquesne University. Her poetry has appeared in YOP, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and the Comstock Review. She was a featured reader at a session devoted to border crossing poetry at the 2010 Northeast Modern Language Association meeting in Montreal, and was a 2009 finalist for the Patricia Dobler Poetry Award. Her poetry manuscript is entitled Boundary Waters. Hi, Roberta. How you doing?
I'm doing fine, Jan. How are you?
Good. It's great to have you here. We've been talking about having you for a while, so it's a good day.
It's great to be here.
So you're going to start with some poems from your manuscript, Boundary Waters.
Mm-hmm, I will. I'm not going to read from the title poem because the poem, Boundary Waters, itself is kind of sprawling. It's goes through the whole collection like small haiku islands among the rest of the work. But I will read poems from the work. This first one is one of the first boundaries I think I had to cross, and that was from academic life to poetic practice. And so this was inspired after seeing the poet Harriet Mullen perform at give a reading at Pittsburgh. This is called Men of Letters. Lately, my neighbor has been sleeping with the dictionary. At night, through the walls, I hear them laughing. I try not to listen to their unholy noise, the thumping of consonants, the low moan of vowels, the scream of exploding syntax. At times I can hardly bear it. Lying awake in the dark, I remember my own lettered youth, the potent musk of all-night etymologies, the artful seduction of homonyms, unpunctuated rendezvous, synonymous trysts, the 26 positions of the alphabet, time unfolding in the endless present of life as an intransitive verb. But all that is past. Alas, dear reader, I married Chicago Manual of Style. He seemed so confident, so steady, so sure of my unreferenced past, he knew nothing. But now, how I hate him as he lies there inert, sleeping the satisfied sleep of the just. He's grown fat on footnotes, priggish and pedantic. Why must he always be right? Why must the world be so rigidly ordered? And style? What style? This manual has no style. Have you ever seen him sporting a paperback or hanging out in front with the pocket size? Ah, dear reader, I have a confession. Today I had lunch with Thesaurus. I was left breathless. He was dazzling, so imaginative and subtle. Most important, he made me feel singular again. I know this adventure may bring heartbreak and misery, but Chicago Manual need never know. Besides, as they say, it's only lunch, or luncheon, or snack, spread, bite, collation, from the Latin collatio. Okay, I have another one that was also inspired in a way by Harriet Mullen's kind of language play, which attracts me because she puts it to serious political purpose. I think the poem I just read is kind of a tarted up version of what she does, but although what she does is very sexy and serious at the same time. So this one, I wrote it last April, and I was trying to figure out a way to respond to what was happening in the country at the time. And so this was published in the Post-Gazette, actually, in April. It's called Thank You for Crawling. Thank you for crawling. Your fall is unimportant to us. Due to the unusually heavy volume of newly transferred wealth, we are experiencing significant delight. Stay in line, and one of our agents will deal with you curtly. Your request will be manhandled in the disorder we've unleashed. In order for us to better unnerve you in the future, this collapse may be monitored for taming purposes. To expedite your falter, you may choose from the following rejections. Please pay attention as obligations have changed. Para Español, leave this country. Go home. To review your account decimation, enter 401k. To report a lost or stolen future, hang up and try again later. If you would like to make a payment, press 0. Our fast operators are standing by to assail you. Please have your carte blanche ready. To speak with a representative, a large campaign contribution is required. Press Fortune 500. To return to the pain menu, stay online. Get hung up. Roll for 7 and wish upon a star. Okay. This one is from Boundary Waters, and it's called French Lesson Number 3. 1. The present is tense. 2. The past compounds our problem. Completed actions require an auxiliary. We all need help when putting together the past. To be, without object, in transit between birth and death, to rise, to fall, to stay or leave, or to have, direction, an objective, having, always taking. Choose one of these to help you. 3. Memory is imperfect, as we've been over. Whether the day was yellow or red, however vivid in your mind's eye, imperfect. The streets of your childhood, the air in that house, diffuse, like fog. The list of imperfections is long. Emotional states, static conditions. We didn't know. We couldn't have foreseen. Repeated behaviors, and we would again and again and again. Actions interrupted, secondary players hovering in the background. What were you doing when? Name your cohort's catastrophe here, JFK, the Challenger, Columbine, the Twin Towers, Katrina. When Wall Street pulled the trigger, what were any of us doing when the music suddenly stopped? 4. To have had, more than perfect, before the past that was. 5. The future approaches. The future is near. I am going to go.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Roberta Hatcher, reading from her manuscript entitled Boundary Waters. I was wondering, Roberta, about the title of your book. I mean, you sort of introduced your first poem by talking about boundaries, and I'm wondering if it's actually an organizing principle in the book?
Yeah, probably these three poems might not be the most representative, but it's an organizing principle in the sense the title comes from a region in northern Minnesota, a wilderness area that borders on Canada. And it's just as much water as it is land. And so it's kind of, I use it as an organizing principle about kind of liminal spaces, liminal states, crossing borders of culture, crossing borders of language. But the problem is a lot of times when I write poems, they come out as little fragments. And that's not a deliberate organizing principle. It just happens. And so I decided to scatter those fragments throughout the book, kind of in the way that islands are scattered around throughout the water. But it's so I just decided that really doesn't maybe lend itself to a radio reading. But thematically and stuff, I think it emerges in what I do.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying you have some poems appearing as fragments in the book, or
mm-hmm. yeah,
really,
yeah, they're kind of in clumps, and some start out as, for instance, boundaries, cultural boundaries, and then I have what I'm What I've done, when you see traditional haiku collections, a lot of times they'll have a little bit of prose in between the haiku, like travel journal kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I've used that principle to have a few chunks. Some then have to do with boundaries of physical boundaries. There's a whole series around question of childbirth, and so border between between self and other. And then there will be a section of poems that are longer and more developed that are related to that. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how it works structurally in the book.
Hmm. Yeah, I noticed
No,
go ahead.
You'll have to buy the book to see the boundary waters, let's just say.
Okay. Yeah, I noticed that you described it as small haiku islands, which I thought was very cool. all right. And just for our listeners, I might ask, you know, for people putting books together, what happens if you write a whole bunch of poems that have nothing to do with boundaries? Are you putting them in the book?
No, they're for another book.
Really?
whose organizing principle I hope will emerge once I have enough of them. For instance, Thank You for Crawling, that will not be in the book. That came from a different impulse.
Huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be a shame to not have those poems in there, though. I mean, you could just have a section called Outside the Boundary.
I like that. Thank you.
Yeah. Anyway.
You have to buy an addendum. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. How about some more poems then?
Okay. The next one I'll start with, this is, I was having problems with all that fragmentation and all those chunks. And so I'll read this one because it has a Pittsburgh connection. And this is in the book Boundary Waters. I had begun reading the poems of Jack Gilbert, whom I found just to be someone of great interest because his poems seem to have such integrity. And I mean that on every level. So this is called Copybook, and it's kind of on the principle, you know, when you go into museums and you see all those art students kind of standing in front of paintings, and they've got their sketchbook and they're copying. So this is called Copybook. Because the day's grayness as yet has no shape, because resting form from this morning will require much heavy lifting, more than I have the heart or muscle for, because I see in these poems something sinuous and hard, a rigor I have come to admire, even in my ignorance of its workings, because I have, like dried beans or lentils, little flavor of my own, but benefit from strong company. Have you been spending time with Kathy Regan again, my mother would say, noting her distinctive rhythms marking my monkey ear speech? And finally, perhaps, because I love their somber sadness in my mouth, I take up my pen and notebook to copy, not imitate, not play with, not take as point of departure, but rather record, whole, moving solemnly down my page, the poems of Jack Gilbert's Refusing Heaven. A certain way of paying attention, a caress that lingers with the slowness love requires. Okay, this is another poem from the collection that also has an oblique Pittsburgh collection. This is an ekphrastic poem, actually, which is usually a poem written in response to a painting, but I prefer movement. So this is written in response to a dance, but it comes from a performance by the Marie Chouinard Dance Company from Quebec that I saw in 2004 when the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust hosted a whole Quebec Festival of Culture and the Arts. And what happened, there was actually, there were two people on the stage, and one just kept repeating this syllable, fa, fa, fa. And later, when I was kind of playing around in the dictionary, I discovered that the solfège, the do, re, mi, fa, originally comes from a hymn to St. John. And St. John is the patron saint of Quebec. And so that kind of gave me an in to maybe what was going on in the stage. And I have to say, rereading this poem, which has to do with a notion of foiled nationhood, really struck me what we're going through right now. I suddenly had a different reading of it. So this starts out with an epigraph by the Martinican poet Aimé Césaire, "À petits pas de cicatrices mal fermées," with small steps like a scar poorly closed. St. John's Song for Marie Chouinard. Singer to public, sang fa, 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 mi, fa. Dancer to singer turned and told of a thousand laments in the bend of a back, of unfathomed force in the feel of a foot on the earth, this soil, this toil, history's royal in the writhe of a wrist, a phantom hymn in the lift of a limb, pulsed in a pose, secreted in a syllable, fa, 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 mi, fa, farther than your voice can carry, I carry, carry this scarred body, my heavy country bends, bound, bounded, wounded, winds here, winds up here, cannot sing, cannot take wing, cannot win here, how here, spine spins, splits, splayed, praise open here, orphan pain pining here, fear breathes, rends, bends, back, bent, back, bent, back. Fa, 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 mi, fa, farther than your vision can reach, I seek a soul's leap in the arc of an arm, a landscape limbed in the nape of a neck, a people's past rhythming a spin, a future forms in the weave of a space, in the turn of a race, in the dare of a dream breaking out, breaking bounds, bursting, birthing, open here, landscape and limb, memory and dream unfolding here, claiming, proclaiming here, fa, 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 mi, fa. A force sweeps forward, faceless, leaving silence behind it here. Furious voice, foiled here, space, contained, fades farther, fades. Dancer to silence turned and turned, mourned, mourned, fade.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Roberta Hatcher. She's reading from her manuscript entitled Boundary Waters. Well, you know, when you're saying that fa-fa stuff, I could think of as David Byrne.
Oh, yeah.
And Psycho Killer. But that's another... But I was
different
wondering...
Different context, yeah.
It's a different context, but I was wondering if he was thinking the same thing in terms of wordplay and the French, but he's not here, so we can't ask him. But that last poem really has a lot of wordplay in it, and I was thinking what you said about Harriet Mullen, how you're attracted to her wordplay. Mm-hmm. And then you talking about Jack Gilbert, how much you like his work. And their work is so different. I mean, Gilbert is so narrative. I'm thinking you like a wide range of poetry, but can you talk about that?
That
boundary.
Huge gap, yeah.
That boundary.
Yeah, it's a problem. when I mentioned in the Gilbert poem about my monkey ear speech, I really kind of have to be careful who I read because I do start, if it's someone I'm drawn to, I start absorbing it, you know, almost despite myself. I'm drawn to Jack Gilbert actually mostly out of acknowledgement of the distance. You know, my poetry is very different from his. And so that was kind of like a discipline for me to see if I could write something that actually moved whole down a page. Mm-hmm. But I am drawn to a lot of different kind of poetry, and I have kind of competing poetic impulses in myself, which I think is what prevented me for a long time from like sending poems out to publish, or the sense that most poetry collections you see now, someone has a very recognizable style, voice, thematic unity, all that kind of stuff. And I'm really kind of all over the map. And finally, I decided, okay, take that as your problem or as a central question. But actually, in the The one that I just read, the fa-fa-fa, the most direct influence for that language play, surprisingly enough, is Gerard Manley Hopkins. Mm-hmm. I sat down and read The Leaden Echo and The Golden Echo because there was a dialogue going on between the speaker and the dancer on the page that made me think of that. Mm-hmm. And there was something about his self-generating language that worked its way into that poem. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, a lot of different mm-hmm. different influences.
I think it's a good thing that you have all different styles and forms and ways of writing it. I mean, you'll see that in some books. A lot of the poems look alike, or maybe have a certain way of constructing themselves, but I don't think that's necessary.
Well, I think that one thing I've discovered is I'm trying to – maybe that's one of the boundaries I'm trying to blur. You know, the opposition between – I mean, the whole notion of what's called language poetry, and as if that is somehow detached from social concerns or from anything more personal. I mean, but – sometimes different approaches might lend themselves to different kinds of poems.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I think, you know, you have to write the poem in the way it needs to be written. And,
right.
You know, I think, yeah, it would be tragic to force something into a certain form or a certain way of writing or thinking.
Yeah, it feels like cutting a part of yourself, you know, off.
Right.
Yeah. So actually, I kind of have a poem about that, that I realized much longer after I wrote it. It's kind of indirectly in Ars Poetica.
Oh, can you read it?
Yeah. It's called Joker's Wild, and at the time I was struggling with the tension between depth and surface play, struggling with actually the question of irony and its place and everything. So this is called Joker's Wild. And I should say, I used to live on an island up in northern Wisconsin, up on Lake Superior. So that's kind of where some of this comes from. In the Lake Superior winter, an ice road is formed to drive from island to mainland. 6 inches of ice can hold a car over water 200 feet deep. I slowly move across. The tires over snow creak, shipwreck, shipwreck, shipwreck. The boys build an oval racetrack, and in their junk cars circle and play, performing dazzling spins and turns, collide, slide into nothing. Some years a crack opens, swallowing the occasional truck or Cadillac. One couple from the city tried to move a house across, attached to the back of a semi. Fish now swim in its kitchen. Ice, like fire, good for some things, not for others. Okay. Then that would take me, I guess, maybe into some of the poems that I consider more poems of depth. This is called Last Poem, and it also makes its way, and it's also in the collection Boundary Waters. It's kind of about crossing the final boundary. Frequently, poets who write a last poem are addressing the people they're leaving behind, and I really couldn't get my head around that, so I addressed mine elsewhere. Last Poem. I wish I knew why you left early. Just as the gathering was swelling to fullness. When the host announced you had gone, we were stunned into pained and awkward silence. Since your presence was the reason I was there at all, I considered leaving too. But ever the dutiful daughter, as you'd say, out of impotence or politeness, I stayed. Slowly the wine and time did the trick. A quick joke here, an anecdote there, and soon the evening was flowing again. Will you forgive me? I even danced and laughed as we licked the last juices from the bursting red berry dessert. Outside, the night waited, then grew tired of waiting, and went about its business in the dark. I finally left alone, with my brain on fire and my chest burning from a last dose of eau de vie. I unsteadily made my way home. The cool night air, the sound of wind like a river, awakened me. I wonder now what will transpire, the complicated reckoning that awaits us. This is another one called American Notebook. And this is also in fragments, but they're a little bit longer than fragments. It's more like chunks. So, American Notebook. Below my window, drunk people are singing. It's a party across the street. After the first line, they don't know the words. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. The voices drift apart. They don't know the tune either. Sometimes wanting is not enough. We are driving down the highway, and you know the words to every song. The windows frost up with the wetness of our breath, like music made visible. Before laughing, we wipe it away. The car rolls like a cloud over the Minnesota plain. I wonder if you ever think of that day. We sit undressed at your kitchen table. We've been sitting here 3 days. How did we embark on this adventure? Afternoon of pot and opera, then brandy, cigarettes. Now, 2 remaining Marlboros mark the end. I had brought you a tape, Keith Jarrett at Köln, alone with a piano. The music holds, withholds. One moment as he plays, he softly moans. You teach me how to listen like an initiation. Sex is everywhere, the square root of everything. I've come alone to this city where I'm soothed after travel by a cool shower and smooth sheets on my skin. In the room next door, heels click click on the floor, moving with purpose like European women do. Then I hear laughter and the sound of young women singing "Where Have All the Flowers Gone?" in German. Everything here is like that, familiar yet strange. Last week, it was Beyond the Sea in French, taking me back to the bar on the lake, that summer, that jukebox, that dance we should never have danced. Now I learn that Beyond the Sea was written first in French. Its A-side, Mac the Knife, was German. I don't know anymore where anything begins or ends. People had assembled for a party. We had heard there'd be a band. The band was late, the night adrift. Thinking of nothing, I picked up a dead electric guitar and faced to the wall, fingered a blues in E. When someone turned on the amp, I jumped, then turned to see the room erupt in dancing. I held the rhythm as long as I could, which was not long, then, terrified, fled. I often regret the times I've been unable to rise to the occasion. After Simon and Garfunkel split up, Paul Simon changed the keys to all his tunes. I'm tired of writing songs, he said, for Art Garfunkel to sing. But when they played together in Central Park years later, the songs were back in Art's key, and Paul Simon never looked nor sounded so radiant. Bob Dylan wanted to be the next Elvis. I once wanted to be the next Bob Dylan. He came closer to his mark, of course. But when I hear those lovesick songs he's made lately, some days I'm not so sure.
The poetry of Roberta Hatcher. Thank you so much for being here. It was great.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Wednesday night at 7:30 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.